You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. Appreciate you tuning in. You just been listening to Alex Dormont's band. What's that?
Hot Texas Swing Band. And we're so delighted that you are here with us tonight. I hope you were tapping your toes like we were. This is episode 197, and it will be legendary, won't it?
It will be.
Oh, yes, it will be. We are delighted to have you with us tonight, whether you might be joining us live or you're catching this on the replay or later on Podbean on your favorite audio podcast channel. We are delighted that you are here. And Jim. We got such a great show. Who's joining us tonight?
Well, we have Robert Prather.
And
we have Cyrus, J.C. Alderwood.
Yes, and here comes Cyrus, or J.C. to his friends. We're going to call him J.C. But if you're looking for the book, you want to remember. What name do you want to remember, J.C., if you're looking for the book?
If any of my books, Cyrus Alderwood.
Yes, Cyrus Alderwood. Well, hello, Robert and Cyrus. Robert, where are you joining us from?
Near Garrett, Kentucky.
Okay.
My wife and I live just a few miles out of a small town in Kentucky. It's called Garrett.
Okay. Garrett. Oh, like the name of one of our characters.
Well, now we know where it came from.
and JC, where are you tonight?
I'm in my hometown of Richlands, Virginia, which is in the southwestern corner of Virginia and near the Tennessee border.
All right. Well, we are so delighted that you're both with us. And Jim, where are we tonight?
Well, I'll tell you, we're in Washington, D.C. to talk to Robert and J.C. about their new book, The Maryland Deposition.
Merlin.
We are on the steps of the Smithsonian Museum. I see Race Garrett, the museum director. He's coming out the side door. And he's running to us. Looks like he has a white bound leather book.
Oh my God.
And he's handing it to you. Bobby, what did he say?
He said, guard it with your life.
I see a big man getting out of a black car across the street. He has a gun with a silencer and he's coming our way. Bobby, why are our interviews always so complicated?
To our audience, that's a little teaser about what we'll be talking about tonight.
That's correct.
Well, this book, The Merlin Deposition, I'm going to just hold it up to the camera again, and you can see we are avidly reading this book. Oh, my goodness, gentlemen, what a romp through the Dark Ages and right up to contemporary times. We couldn't put it down. So whole sections we had to go and read again. We had to learn how to say a lot of names that had G's and W's and double D's and things in them that we would just point to the word. And readers, our audience, dear readers out there, this needs to be on your book list. And you should get it, have it ready to go, right?
Right.
So let's see, Jim, tell us a little bit about our guests before we get started.
Okay. We have a couple of bios. Robert Prather is the author of the award-winning book, The Strange Case of Jonathan Swift and the Real Long John Silver. He has been featured on the popular series History Channel's America, Book of Secrets, and Travel Channel's Code of the Wild. In 2021, Tim Farmer Productions produced a full-length documentary on his work that was featured on KET. Robert and his wife Karen live in Kentucky. And Cyrus, J.C. Alderwood, known to J.C. as his friends, was born in Florida and raised in Virginia. He has a B.S. in economics and a professional background in investment management. He is a small business owner by day and a writer by night. He is the author of the books Revelation Calling and Pot of Gold.
Happy to have you with us. You know, you contacted us some months ago and you told us what your book was about. And you said, we research King Arthur and we are going to tell your audience why he's real or something like that. So that is what we're going to be discussing tonight. And we just want to say for those of you that are watching live on Facebook, you can see us, but unfortunately we can't see you. We are hoping that as you watch tonight, you'll have some questions or some comments, and you may want to leave us a post. And then, gentlemen, what are we going to do right after the show? Where are we going to go, and what are we going to look for?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to go back and look and see what kind of questions some of the viewers had, or some of the people maybe have already read the book, and what questions they have that we don't get to tonight. Robert and I are going to sit down and do a Zoom video in a handful of days and answer these questions, and we'll post it up on YouTube so folks can go to look for Cyrus Alderwood, my page on YouTube, and you'll be able to watch our answers and discuss the book in a little bit more detail there too.
It's a really, really great suggestion. I know as I was reading, and probably you too, luckily these gentlemen, these co-authors, give us right in the beginning of the book a wonderful two-page sort of major character list of the characters that are in the dark ages. And I had to have that I was so grateful for that. And I was referring to it all the time. And then there was enough room to write a few other characters or a few other thoughts down. So this book is spellbinding. It's a page turner. It has everything, doesn't it?
My goodness. Yes, it does. You know, before we get exactly into the book, there's a little background story about the Smithsonian. Would you like to say something about that?
Why did you set it there?
Yeah, Robert, go ahead and give a little background on that.
There's several reasons why we set it at the Smithsonian. The primary reason was James Smithson, who the Smithsonian was founded for. Mm-hmm. And Smithson, in a roundabout way, ties into our characters. He came from the Percy family. They came from Normandy, France, a little place called Percy in Normandy, France. And they came over with William the Conqueror in 1067, the year after 1066, the Norman invasion. And they settled in the land of Yorkshire. And anyway, that's where the Percy family, who is also kin to the Smithsons. And he's directly related to the Percys. Why that's interesting is they come from an area in Normandy there that was very close to where Chrétien de Troyes lived. They were basically in the same area as him, He's a famous Arthurian writer. He wrote about the Holy Grail, Lancelot, Percival. And anyway, they came from Normandy with William the Conqueror, settled in Yorkshire, which happened to be the land that one of our historical characters was from, Peridur. He lived in the area of Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And so we found that interesting and thought, well, what if, you know, there could be a connection there. And if you think about it, why wouldn't there be the Percy family, the Peridur connection, and Chrétien de Troyes, who wrote about all those wonderful things?
Yeah. And JC, do you want to add anything to that? Like, how did it get, because it is the history of the Smithsonian, how it got founded.
Yeah, it was, I thought it was pretty fascinating. Way to kind of introduce or like have a background setting for the initial part of the book to have it in the Smithsonian. And the fact that, you know, being from Virginia, I can like shoot up to DC and kind of have been there before kind of sort of helped. You know, I did, I got lost on those streets a few times. That DuPont Circle is no joke. Once you're on it, you can't get off. So it was just one of those things that I thought that was a really great tie-in. And it's sort of, you know, when you have a base like that, it helps build characters around it.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, it does. And Smithson, you know, he probably had an opportunity such as museum up in the UK, but he really decided he wanted to come over here.
Yeah, he sent the money, sent the funding over here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So interesting.
We're glad he did.
Yeah, we're glad he did. So how did go ahead.
So we kind of, and JC will tell you there, that we come up with this idea of this ancient codex. And what if it originated at the Smithsonian? And then we thought, well, maybe we'll originate it at Dumbarton Oaks. And Dumbarton happens to be one of the primary place names of our historical characters.
Yeah.
Dumbarton actually means Castle of the Britons. And our king, rather, he was the king of that castle, King of the Britons.
Yeah.
Just like Arthur.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that codex got in the hands of James Smithson, who was related to the Percy family, who could have been related to Peridur. And it was theorized on our part that perhaps Peridur moved off to Normandy area during the time of the Germanic occupation of Britain, when this, especially in that Yorkshire area, was heavily settled by the Angles.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of people didn't like that.
Well, like you told us,
moved to France.
Like you told us, we base our theories on historical documents and historical events and historical, on history. And so that's when we said, okay, we have to have these gentlemen on. We because we want to know.
Well, actually, what sold me was that picture. Let's hold that book up.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Merlin, there he is. Oh, my goodness.
You said never judge a book by the cover, but this time I decided I judged the book by the cover.
You know, I like that too. I was going to say, a good friend of mine always said that whatever your book cover is, that's your promise to the reader. You know, so make sure that your cover is going to be something that's, you want it to catch people's attention, but you don't want to lie to the reader about what's inside.
Right, right. So how did you two meet?
Well, a mutual friend, a business partner of mine, Dr. Gary Stratton. Robert had written the book on the Swift Silver legend. And through a friend of a friend, we'd sort of met, and he had gotten a hold of asked for a copy of one of my books that I'd written called Revelation Calling. And I got that in his hands, and he read that. And then go ahead, Robert. We kind of got in touch after that and talked more.
That's right. I guess we won't mention any names, but through this documentary that was based upon my book on Jonathan Swift, and The Real Long John Silver was the title of it. And anyway, Tim Farmer, a guy that's a PBS affiliate with KET, became interested in it. Gary, our mutual friend, approached Mr. Farmer. And anyway, we made a full-length documentary on it. And that's how JC and I linked up, is through this mutual friend.
Yeah. So the inspiration behind the book, were you both very knowledgeable about Camelot, King Arthur and such, or was one of you and then the other one had another important role to play? Tell us a little bit about how that came to about.
Robert is the historian on that. He's followed it for a long time. My background on it was, like, I enjoyed Excalibur from the 80s, right? So I'd heard the legend, and that was about it. But Robert took me to school when it came to this whole learning the history. Go ahead and kind of jump into that, Robert.
Oh, I agree. Excalibur was a great movie. That was inspirational. I love the Arthur and Lancelot and all those tales from long ago, but that one there got me reinterested. But I actually became interested in our King Arthur candidate back in the, I'd say, mid to early 90s. when I started researching this King Ruthric Hale. His name is similar phonetically to King Arthur in that it's based on place names and surnames. His name is probably pronounced Ruther. As a matter of fact, my name derived the name, not necessarily my branch, but the Prather name derived from this King Ruther. In other words, that Ap Ruther is how that works. Then they took the AP and put it on the Ruther and made Prather. So that's how I became interested in that. And how come I kept researching King Ruther was because of that. I wanted to see how, you know, the Prathers hooked into this guy. And so I kept digging and digging through the years, and it was just kind of a light research for many years. And then I finally hit a point and I thought, good night. How many similarities can this guy have to King Arthur and Camelot? Mm-hmm. And that was the surprise, is that I actually believe that I found the origins of Camelot through this King Ruther.
Yes. And if you read this, the Merlin deposition, you will come to the same conclusion and you will want to go and learn even more.
One of the things I like so much that Robert wanted to do is at the end of the book, let's just lay out all the research. You know, don't take our word for it. If you want to go down that trail, Robert laid all that out for you at the end of the book.
Since you're talking about that, JC, I'm just holding up to the camera trying to do my Vanna White impression. This is, tell us about this page, which is just, you just want to sit and look at it for the longest time, and how ties Arthur all together, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And this was sort of, you know, I don't know whose idea it was, whether it was Robert's or mine, but we were going through all these different things that, that the King Arthur legend had in common with Ruther Hale. And, I thought, you know, we should have like a spoken wheel, and it's like have like everything pointing back to him. And again, in the book, we sort of mentioned like all the circumstantial evidence, but that's all you really have in history a lot of times. And all that's an awful lot of circumstantial evidence pointing back to one guy to be the candidate for like who the real King Arthur might have been based on. And but each one of those are points that Robert had researched and kind of walked me through over several months going over the research with me, each one of those 27 spokes.
We designed that together. That was part of the some of the good stuff that come out of our joint co-author adventure here. That was a joint discovery.
It's powerful, and it is part of the story because Owen, I think Owen Davies is the kind of the creator of that. And as they're getting more and more information and they're laying those spokes down, aren't they? So Robert, are you Owen in the story? Maybe?
No. I don't think I'm necessarily either anyone in the story. We wanted to come up with, we developed Race Garrett because we thought, why don't we have a historical archaeologist? And because that's the time period that we're looking at with these historical characters. And why didn't he become a historical archaeologist and department head at the Smithsonian Institute? Right. So that was part of the creative process that JC and I started from scratch on. Hammered out a pretty good event here.
Well, yeah, you know, the unique thing about the whole combination between Owen Davies and Race Garrett is that he was certainly a mentor to Race. Kind of, and I sort of looked at it like you have Merlin and Ruther, the wise man and the king, and then now you have, you know, the wise sage and Race Garrett, his protege. And again, we wanted it to be kind of really exciting in a, I don't know, not in an Indiana Jones sort of way because that's a different time period, but you definitely want to have an exciting character with some action. And I think Race Garrett sort of fit that bill.
Right. We're going to step away for a moment And when we come back, we're just going to pick up what we've been talking about. We're going to take just a quick listen for a spot from our sponsor, Blue Cottage Agency. Are you a writer? Are you looking to increase your book's visibility, eager for a public book tour, thinking about updating your website? Here's a word from our sponsor, Blue Cottage Agency. And when we return with our special guests, Robert and JC, in just a moment, don't go away. There's more to come. You're invited to join the team. Up your author brand when you team up with Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, specializing in author branding, digital book tours, book reviews, and social media. Experienced, trusted, effective. Get noticed. Visit BlueCottageAgency.com and ClicksByMadison.com. Proud sponsors of Rendezvous with a Writer.
Welcome back to Money with the Writer. We're talking with Robert and JC about this great book, The Merlin Deposition. Now, we've just been listening to, what do we got here? Epic Adventure from the album Epical.
Yes.
Performed by Vladimir Osipov.
Yeah, it's a really, really wonderful instrumental album. It just felt like all the music on it somehow fit for
where you found
tonight's
this.
Show. Oh, I just went hunting.
We were all over the place.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's one of the joys. It's one of the joys of what we do. Do you want to start us off with this great question that we have?
Well, first of all, I want to establish a time period. We're actually at two time periods because this is the Bird story. You got two storylines in this book that you want to just might mention here in a moment. But the King Arthur part is 500 to 600 AD, and it's called the Dark Ages. I want to review question. Why is it called the Dark Ages?
JC?
Well, there's in history, there's really not a lot of information found back then. So you didn't really have, I guess with the fall of the Roman Empire and that power vacuum, you didn't have people that were actively keeping records. The ones who really were, I guess, were places like monasteries and maybe some of the wealthier that knew how to read and write, because you had a drop off in literacy and I guess just general education. And there was a period of, maybe two or 300 years, Robert, I guess, where people just didn't really have access to information or books. But at the same time, there's a lot of oral tradition storytelling that was passed down that eventually got recorded.
Yeah. I think a lot of that oral storytelling probably came back after the Britons, or I'm sorry, after the Romans left. A guy by the name of Gildas is about the only historian during the time period of Arthur. And he didn't mention Arthur. He didn't mention him at all. One thing that he did do was mention a battle that has long been associated with King Arthur, and that's the Battle of Badon Hill. And that took place around the time period that Gildas was born, I think around the year 500, maybe. People want to, for some reason, because one of the later historians referred to that battle being associated with Arthur, but there's no proof to that, really. And the trouble is it sets the time period of Arthur too far back. It sets him back before Merlin, before Peridur, before Balagap Lenog, and all of these different people that we know is associated with King Rother. It sets him way back too far for that. Go ahead, Jim.
No. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm kind of fascinated when you talk about your research. You know, and we definitely bring out this book when it comes to translations.
Oh, yeah.
When you went to look at things, were they in regular English, or were they in an old type English? Did you have to get a translator for some of your research?
Yeah.
No, we didn't go there. Everything we had was, you know, already translated into English for us. Thank goodness.
Because you did do a lot of research. You showed us a book the other night, or something that you had used. It had more post-it notes in it than I have ever seen in a manuscript or a book. More, you know, like you must have gone through. Look at this. This is so fascinating.
The triads of Britain. And yeah, here's just a few of the notes I've got in there. To say the least, this was instrumental in a lot of things.
Yeah.
And we list all our sources in the back of the book. That was one of the primary sources. A little book written by Geoffrey of Monmouth, of all people, called Vita Merlini. Is also one of our primary books. And then another primary book where we got a lot of our storyline information from was written by a monk named Jocelyn of Furness,
yes, yeah,
who lives in the Cumbric area. And he wrote on the life of St. Kenadurn. Okay. And that is just about like reading our historical work that we put in this Merlin book.
So yes. I have to ask this question. Why is the story of King Arthur and all that goes along with it, Camelot, the Round Table, all of the things that most of us, when you say King Arthur, you just immediately, you know, you have a flashback to this or that. Why is this story so important and even relevant today?
I think, you know, this is something that I've been asked, you know, a handful of times. And not only is it important because, you know, if there was no King Arthur story, would we have had a Lord of the Rings story, a Hobbit story? Would we, because, you know, obviously Gandalf was kind of a mimic in a way of Merlin. Would we have had the Harry Potter series? You know, these types of things where you have these types of characters. But it's not necessarily the story. You know, we were talking about this yesterday. And, you know, when you look around at the world, just, you know, sometimes you just see chaos. You spend an hour watching the news. You're like, what is going on in the world? But, you know, when you think about something like King Arthur, you know, why do these heroes and legends matter? It's because, you know, deep down, I think we all want to believe that goodness still matters. And we live in this chaotic world that can sometimes make cynicism feel like wisdom, which it's not. And, you know, we see a lot of things like betrayal and violence and corruption all over, you know, everything. And then people seem to get ahead doing the wrong things. But yet every generation, from going back to the ones who read the, you know, the Lord of the Rings and forward, and even before that, every generation, I think they still reach for stories that, you know, that for someone who stands up for what's right, even when it's a lot easier to walk away, or someone who keeps their word when breaking it's like more profitable, or so, you know, someone who protects the vulnerable, someone who chooses courage over fear. And you know, when you think about that courage over fear thing, we can all put that in our own lives. And I think of that specifically with a sister of mine who passed away, and she had battled cancer for some years, but for a time it was all that, you know, courage over fear, faith over fear. And sometimes those tough choices are the right choices instead of the easier choices. And why King Arthur and the legends surrounding him have survived for centuries, they're not about swords or castles or magic. It's about that eternal question that we sort of all ask ourselves, is like, what kind of person do I want to be when the moment comes for me to choose? And I think when readers encounter a story like that and you know, characters like that, it reminds us that we don't outgrow heroes. And even at our age, we need them now more than ever.
We need
yeah,
them.
It gives us something to reach towards. It shows us that, you know, honor isn't foolishness. It's not, courage isn't obsolete.
Chivalry. You know,
yeah, chivalry.
That's what the Arthur is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if the Merlin deposition can make someone, you know, close the book and think, I want to be a little more like that hero I just read about, whoever it is you gravitate to in that story, then the story did its job, you know?
There's just no way to know how many different ways that King Arthur has affected this nation and the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about it. What do you think of when... when your boss says we're going to have a round table about this.
Yeah. All of the
that's what you think about.
That's yep. referring to King Arthur yeah. and the Knights of yeah. the Round Table. And that was yeah. that's one thing that is presented in our book. We believe that we have found the actual building. Now it's no longer standing, but I think they actually tore it down back in the 1700s. But that building stood a long time. They actually had a design of it, and it was referred to as Arthur's Oven.
Wow.
They also also refer to it as Arthur's Hall. They refer to it as the oven because it apparently was very hot. And it was what it was an old Roman temple. But there again, this King Ruther, that was in his kingdom. This round building, an old Roman building. And if you had a table in it, it by necessity had to be round.
Right.
And here he is in league with all these different known knights of the round table, Urien, yeah. one of the famous ones, Peredur, maybe the most famous outside of Lancelot. And then, of course, he was also linked up with Gwalag ap Lenog, mm-hmm. one of the great heroes of the Henoglid, which was the Old North. The Old North is an important thing mm-hmm. in when it comes to telling these King Arthur stories. When they say the Old North, they're actually referring to the Old North of Britain, Britain's former head. And so that and that battle that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes. Go ahead.
There is a scene in the book I had to read and reread and reread because it was so powerful. The whole book is cinematic. I can see it. You know, happening on the big screen. But this scene, I would like you to tell us about it, is, of course, the scene at Stonehenge with Merlin and our future King Arthur, who is being coronated. It's powerful. Tell us about that scene.
JC, you want to chime in on this? I was the primary guy that provided that, but
I'd like
your take on it.
Yeah, you know, Robert wrote that scene. We wanted to have a scene where, because Stonehenge is such a powerful place, and such legend and mystery still surrounding it. And there's an element of, just stargazing and kind of reading the stars, and that was part of Merlin's learning. And Merlin was chosen to coronate Rother, as his father had died and they were transitioning, and they hustled down to, in this particular scene, they hustled down to Stonehenge, which was the sacred area where they were going to coronate the new king.
And Merlin refers to it as the ancient crown of the island of Britain.
Right.
And that's what he refers to Stonehenge as, so the ancient crown of the island of Britain.
And one of the things, when the first time I read this, that when Robert wrote it, I knew where we're going to put it at in the book, just the way in the coronation scene, the way Merlin and Robert can explain this a little bit better, kind of laid out the scene of the stars and the ley lines and kind of wrapped things into in a mystical way, that magical way, and presented him with White Hilt, which is the sword of Rother, now who takes the name Arthur at that particular point. And, just the fact that you had this sword, it wasn't pulled from a stone, but it was coronated and special made by Waylon the Smithy, right?
This legendary in his own right, yeah.
Yeah, a legendary historical real figure. So he made this sword and presented it to Merlin to present to Rother, which was very much an Excalibur kind of sword,
number one. It's number one on the 13 treasures of the island of Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
The sword of Ruther Hale is number one on the list. And it was a powerful sword. Legend has it, if you unsheathed it, if an unworthy person unsheathed it, it burst into flame. But Ruther Hale gained his sobriquet, the Hale part. Hale means generous. He gained that through, he would offer to loan that sword to someone. But nobody took him up on it.
We knew what would happen, huh?
Is there a do you have it hanging behind you, Robert? Is it there on the wall behind
that is,
you?
I just to commemorate JC and my work, I had this sword made by a good friend of mine, and which I now refer to as Norman the Smithy.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is alludes to his name, but yeah, he did a wonderful job on that. And this is White Hilt, as you can see.
This is White Hilt, yes, yes. In the coronation scene, which JC, one of the things you were talking about is the stars and looking up and that whole part of it. But to me, what I had to reread several times, just a few sentences, but it had to do with the Holy Grail in a different kind of way than most of us, you know, think of the Holy Grail. And I found that just fascinating. The stars and the land coming together. Can you take a, I know I'm just, we're okay on time because this is an important question.
Yeah. And Robert, you can take that too. But you know, one of the things that stood out is when we had a review of the book before it came out, we had a well-known archaeologist and author actually write a review for the jacket. But you know, what that meaning and, as in heaven, let it be on earth. It really kind of has a whole new meaning when you look at King Arthur, Stonehenge, and what happened there. You'd never look at Stonehenge the same way again after reading this book. And so we did sort of combine the issue of ley lines that I thought was really fascinating. It's really detailed to kind of get into. But Robert, you had wrote that, so you've done research on that, and that famous Z you showed me on the map you drew. I'll let you jump into that.
Ray Scarrett refers to it as the Big Z. And what that actually refers to, and we based a whole lot of this star archaeology, I guess you'd call it, on that Big Z. And what inspired that were the two existing ley lines, St. Michael's alignment and St. Michael's line. St. Michael's line runs from Mont St. Michael in Cornwall to Israel and Mount Carmel in Israel, and it's just a straight line from there. And why they call that St. Michael's line is there's several churches and places that are associated with St. Michael along that line.
Literally on it.
Literally on that line. Yeah. And then the same, there's another line. So just imagine that angle coming from Israel to Cornwall. And then there's another angle that's referred to as St. Michael's alignment that runs through the body of Britain. And we suppose, well, what if that's an interrupted line? So we came up with a postulated line and thought, well, let's take the length of the same, the one that we've got that runs to Mount Carmel, make it the same length, give it the same angle that St. Michael's alignment runs on, and take it on out. And what it does, it runs clear to Russia. And then if you take that and take that same wedge and flip it over, what would happen then? And that's where we come up with the postulated line. And we actually found where that line runs through St. Michael's, a place called St. Michael in Russia. And so that's pretty cool.
What are the odds?
What are the odds? Yeah.
I know you have a question.
Archangel. Yeah, Archangel.
Well, you know, we briefly mentioned here 13 treasures of Britain. What is that? What are they? Is that something current, or is that really from the times we were talking about?
It's been around a long time. No way of knowing just how long it's been. It just goes back to the Britonic and Celtic literature and folklore. So we don't know for sure how old that is. You may have someone that's wanting to dispute its importance, but the fact is that it's there. It's in this book that I showed you earlier, the triads of Britain. They're listed in there. If you're But you can go on Wikipedia and find that, the 13 treasures of the island of Britain. Yeah. And several of those treasures relate to our story.
Yes, they do.
Well, they do.
They might be using them in a sequel.
We're going to mention just one of them. Yeah, because I don't think it's necessarily a spoiler alert, but you got one of them, the chessboard with a couple
of pieces. Chessboard.
And they play chess on their own.
Interesting ones, yeah.
Yeah.
They're cool.
Yeah,
Gracie wrote some good stuff on that.
Yeah, the magical chessboard and you have to have all the pieces, and it sort of plays itself out. So it's kind of, I don't know, I would say like a Dark Ages Ouija board in a sense. But yeah, the way we worked that into the story was gave it a little bit of a creepy edge there, didn't it?
Yes. Yes.
But it certainly had its point, and you know, a lot of those treasures of Britain, I mean, can I relate to this story, the King Arthur legend? It was just sort of amazing how all these little pieces of evidence sort of piling up.
Yeah.
You know, the saucer and the cup and then the cloak and just, you know, all this, the wet
stuff. We had all these historical pieces of evidence, but how do you make them interesting? Well, I found that I need to turn it over to Cyrus Alderwood, and he'll get the job done. And he certainly did made that chessboard of Gwendolyn Absidio very interesting. He even broke out a couple of pieces.
We're gonna step away very quickly, and when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit about some characters. We're not gonna have a lot of time, but we'd like to hit on a couple of other characters. So this is an opportunity to tell you about one of the places you can get the books of many of our author guests, including the Merlin Deposition. Find their books on the Outwest Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Listening to Epic the Way again from Vladimir Osipov. You know, speaking of characters, we need to ask a couple real quick.
Yes.
Grace Garrett, we brought his name up once or twice. What's he got to do with the story?
Well, Grace Garrett is the hero of the story of the outside of King Arthur. We tell this story in two timelines, the historical timeline where you kind of get the real King Arthur legend. And then the modern day story that kind of goes along with it. Race is the guy who sort of runs things there in that department at the Smithsonian, and stumbles across this codex, which turns out to be a diary or you know, some sort of a summary of what happened during those years with Merlin and Rother. So people, that story would be passed down. And once he finds this, somehow word gets out that there's another group of people, invisible hand, so to speak, a secret group that's been looking for this for a long time. So now, little does he know, but he soon finds out that just by having that in his possession, there's some real danger at hand. And so Race, sort of the ringleader of all these this group of people, the Camelot Club with Owen Davies and the people he associated with, have to get through this somehow. They need to know what's in this codex as we translate it from Old Britonic into English, and it's going to take time. So So how does this guy, kind of like a shepherd, kind of keep the sheep, the flock safe, you know, as we go through this? And there's some really dangerous people sort of on his trail. And, you know, he, his job is to kind of keep that codex safe, keep everybody else as safe as he can, and get through this so they can get the truth out. And then, you know, trying to discover a mystery behind the mystery of King Arthur is, who in the heck is trying, who's coming after them? Like that's the part of the story. It's like, all right, we got people behind us, but who are these people? And using his connections, they, you know, he brings, you know, the story with tension really starts to unfold.
They're kind of like some mirror people, because, you know, in Arthur's day, we have Mordred, and, you know, and then in the contemporary time, we have Nigel, and we have, you know, it's kind of like we have, we got the Camelot Club, which is a little bit like the Round Table, and then we got the evil forces that, you know, are going after them. It's a thrilling ride.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing, when you're going to tell a story in two time frames, if the King Arthur story is going to be that enthralling, you better have a modern day story or the other story that's just as exciting. Because if you don't, your book sort of falls apart. Your story sort of isn't as good as it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a was a fun challenge to take up.
JC, tell them about the third time period we start out with.
All right, remind me of the third time period.
Sorry. The book's actually set in three time periods. We start out in ancient Egypt.
We started off in ancient Egypt.
JC wrote a prologue. And,
we started
out in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, so a lot of this connected back to ancient Egypt, too. Like, so with this guy by the name of Winnenefer, and you can look him up in history, too. So all these historical figures, they're real people. You know, the modern day characters aren't, but we had to parallel that story with those. So the three time periods, I'd never done anything like that. That was a new one on me. Two was new on me, but three was kind of certainly but it was absolutely fun. And when I learned the history, like the Egyptian connection, with the research there with Robert, it was okay. We got to weave all of it, because you can't not have that in there to kind of lay that groundwork. Because people will read the first part, like, what the heck does this have to do with it? You'll find out.
We are really almost out of time. We want to be sure quickly for you each. We'll start with you, JC. Tell people where and how they can find you and follow you and get the book.
Okay, you can find me under Cyrus Alderwood on Instagram. I do have a website called cyrusalderwood.substack.com that I do like essay writing, book reviews, and just general writing prompts, fun stuff. People can follow me there. You can find all of my books on Amazon.com. Of course, with this book, you can find it on, I think, Barnes & Noble, too, Books A Million. You can go in and get it on bookshelves, because Acclaim Press have published this one, so they got us on all the bookshelves, too. So, but yeah, just look for me on Amazon.com. I have 10 or 12 books probably out there. So pick one you like and have fun.
Start with this one. And Robert, what about you? Working on anything next, and how can people find you?
Well, I'll certainly put a plug in for JC. His books are fantastic. I did read Revelation Calling, and it was a real trip. A Dan Brown page burner. I'm not quite as modern as JC. You can get in touch with me through my publisher, Acclaim Press out of Morley, Missouri, also referred to as Sykeston. They actually operate out of Sykeston, Missouri. And you can find, like JC said, you can get it, should be able to get it at Barnes & Noble. If not, they have it in their warehouse, and Amazon, of course. And I'm just getting started on Facebook, so I'm learning the ropes.
Well, Jim, I think you have, you might have enough time for a quote.
Well, we got a quote from the book. And this is Owen Davies. He's speaking. He's a member of the Camelot Club. And he says, history is the bloody and brutal truth of our humanity when we don't sugarcoat it. It's the tragedy and triumph of mankind. It's every victory and defeat we've ever known to bring us to this point in time. We either learn from it or we're doomed to repeat it. That's the harsh lesson of history.
Thank you both so much.
I know the guy who wrote that.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us tonight. I know we waited a long time to get you on the air. I hope that you enjoyed yourselves with us.
We had a great time. Thanks for everybody. Thanks for all the viewers too. It's been great.
Thank you.
And like I said, every book is a journey. So thank you guys for taking this one with us.
We also just want to take a moment to thank Blue Cottage Agency and Alex Dorma and the Hot Texas Swing Band. Next week, we are eager to chat with a returning guest, R.G. Stanford, and we will be talking about the next book in her series. We'll be talking about book two. This is The Brothers Brown, A Family Saga, part two. She was with us about a year ago with part one, and I know she's eager to come back. And Jim, do you have any other final parting comment?
Well, you know, as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing.
We'll keep reading.
We'll see you down the trail. Good night, gentlemen. Thanks again, good night. Guys. Thanks for being with us.
Good night.
Good night.